I attempted not to put my glasses on, just a French impressionist audience. I'm Wendy. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Wendy.
I guess one thing I was thinking of here is that you know, the lessons or the program is just internal now. You know, I really internalize the steps and the way this fellowship works and is. I'm a little dusty today because my basement flooded about a week ago, and I was cleaning it up before I came here, and it flooded a lot. It was before, so it was so funny because a few days before my basement flooded, a girlfriend's basement flooded, and I kind of gave her this great advice. You know, and I couldn't wait to tell her that I had to use it. But what I told her was, always look for the gift of the situation. And I've really learned to look at things as gifts now. When the doo-doo was hitting the fan, you know, in my life, in the past, and then some of my sobriety, of course, while I was growing up, I was really interested in dramatizing it and kind of having the spotlight on me, you know, and getting that a really nice rush, you know, an alcoholic, you know, boom, you know, where's the drama button? And so now I just feel like, okay, for the simple cost of a deductible, I get a new basement. Yay, I hate that rug. You know, I mean, it's like, I really hate that rug. So, I mean, and it's only things, you know. And I feel happy to be able to kind of have a job and everything that kind of makes things easier that way. Steady income and stuff like that. But anyway, I'll go ahead and tell what it was like, what happened and what it's like now a little bit more. I think my drinking career started, I feel like I was an alcoholic before I started drinking, and I've heard that from others. I was a mess. I know now, it was so weird, you don't know what you don't know. My mom was a mess. You know, both my parents were a mess. You know, one was a practicing alcoholic. One was a, I don't think they called him this, but a practicing codependent. You know, I am one, so I feel like I can say that, you know, there are practicing codependents, and they're very controlling. and so she was really, didn't know how to deal with emotional pain, didn't know how to deal with having kids, didn't know how to deal with marriage, didn't know how to deal with anything. And I am not blaming her one hot second because I know that her family didn't teach her, you know. But that was the kind of environment that I grew up in where, you know, you didn't talk about your thoughts and your feelings and you were always stuffing it, or at least I was, and you're always looking good on the outside, you know, always just kind of making do. And so when I had... my mom was very critical and very, I would call it emotionally abusive. And when I had my first drink, I thought it was heaven. I had, for the first time, relief from that emotional pain. And I feel like a garden variety drunk, because what I'm going to say is what most people say is, you know, I felt like that was the answer. And I was 16 at that time. I grew up in upstate New York, very rural setting, so my drinking was in cornfields with a big kegger, you know what I mean, or little Matt's ponies or whatever we were trying to get away with. During that time, I felt like I fit in with my peers. I wasn't afraid of... I felt like I had kind of fake self... What I call fake self-esteem, you know? And so I could do some of the things that I couldn't do without alcohol, the liquid courage. And so I kind of just drifted from group of people to group of people, trying to kind of fit in and do stuff. Meanwhile, be very interested in getting drunk, very interested in not kind of living in this body, very interested in not feeling anything, and very interested in being cool, you know what I mean? And trying to get in the in group or whatever. You know, I tell my daughter now, who's 11, it's like, don't even worry about those people. I wish someone had said that. Don't worry about those people. But shoulda, coulda, woulda. But I believe that, and I'll get into that in a minute, that my story is my story, and the things that I learned, I was meant to learn, and I'm glad I learned. So here I am, really full of fear. You know, if I was just to describe it, just full of fear. And so, like a good alcoholic, it didn't really take me that long to hit the crash and burn phase. In high school, I don't know exactly what happened, but everything's a little fuzzy back then. But my mom got mad at me because I had left the house when I was grounded. And she locked the doors. And she didn't unlock them. You know, I was 16 years old and I was kicked out of the house. There you go. You know, that was really good drinking material, first of all. You know, the She Done Me Wrong song. You know. And the blame game. But that launched my career big time. I think I lived on Camel cigarettes and Wonder Bread for about a year and slept on people's couches. I mean, I was homeless, you know. Probably a year or less than a year after my first drink, my disease had me homeless. We'll get into my mom's issues of locking the door on a 16-year-old later. But I was free. I felt I was free to drink however I wanted. And let me tell you, I did. I did a lot of other things, too. Drugs. My mom must have got worried about me because she got me to live with my dad, who they had been divorced since I was young. And he was a bigger party than I was. So I thought it was really progressive parenting to be, you know, smoking hash with my dad. I missed 72 days of school that year. And I went to summer school and somehow passed. But anyway, my dad was worried about me too. So he said, here's some money. Why don't you move to Florida with your friends? And so I had both parents kind of kick me out. It's like, okay. But, you know, I still couldn't see my behavior. I still couldn't see that I was a drunk. And in fact, I know now I was kind of a hurting kid. I was just trying to self-medicate, trying to figure out what to do. And they didn't know what to do, you know. They didn't have the tools or whatever. So here I am at you know, barely 17 years old in Florida by myself. And my friends were actually going to college. And I tried to go to college like 3 or 4 times and withdrew just before the money part, you know, before I couldn't get my money back. Because I couldn't do it. My drinking got in the way. I was in Tallahassee, Florida at that time. And so I worked at, worked at restaurants, and I did kind of some menial labor to try to make it. And, you know, I did. And then, you know, I was just hanging around. One of the things my alcoholism did was, in order to feel better about myself, I'd hang out with people who were drinking worse than I was or had, you know, like records or other problems, you know. So I was not hanging around a really great class of people at that time. You know, without going into detail, you know, my life was probably in danger a couple times at least. You know, I was going down. I must have had some sense of self-preservation because I decided to move to Northern Virginia where my family had moved to. Mom was working for the really successful woman, the DOD, you know, she's working at the Pentagon. And my sister was living there too. I have a twin sister, identical. If you're in Springfield at meetings, might not be me. So I moved there and was waiting tables and doing drugs, drinking like a fish, not knowing how I got home. I didn't know what DTs were until I got sober. But I couldn't go to sleep all night because I thought something was going to get me. That should have been a good clue, but it didn't stop me from drinking or telling anyone. I remember a couple times hanging on to the edge of the mattress and just waiting till morning. I was so scared. I was alone, I think, was the biggest problem, desperately alone. I had been waiting tables, and I had started working as a desk clerk at Ramada Inn. And that was a great job for an alcoholic because you don't have to go until 3 if you work second shift, and you don't have to, and you get off in time to drink. So I was doing that, and then a headhunter came in and hired me to be a receptionist at a law firm in Tyson's Corner, which was about an hour bus ride for me. And I took that job, and that was really the beginning of me waking up, because I would hear people at work, you know, with my people at the Ramada Inn, everybody else was doing what I was doing. And in the restaurant business, everybody else was doing what I was doing, but people who were lawyers and paralegals and secretaries weren't doing what I was doing, you know? So there was like this delta of how they were behaving and how I was behaving. And, you know, they said things like, oh, happy hour is really big in the 80s, so this woman was like, oh, I'm not going to have anything to drink. I'm on medicine for for my dental work. I was like, you know, my whole frame of mind on that was like, double up, you know what I mean? I don't know how I'm going to get home, but double up, you know? And so I realized that that thinking was a little off, you know what I mean? And I'm trying to remember how it went, but I was starting to, oh, I know. I couldn't drink during the week because I was scared that I was going to get fired. Okay, so that fear part worked for me then, I guess. So I didn't drink Monday through Friday, and it was really hard, you know? And then once I got comfortable on the job, I made a conscious decision where I said, you know, it's okay for me to go in hungover on Friday. You know, one day a week, right? You know, that great rationalization. And it wasn't long before I did kind of another kind of garden variety drunk thing, which was I woke up with so much guilt and remorse, I couldn't get out of bed. I couldn't even call in, and I felt like I was a pretty good liar. You know what I mean? I could call in, and it was really hard for me when I got sober to call in because I felt like I was lying, because I was so used to lying. But I couldn't even call in. And so people started looking for me. I was glad my boss came looking for me. Do you know what I mean? And I had closed all the windows, curtains, and just was in the dark. I just was sitting in the dark. And I actually don't remember much more than that. But I remember thinking that I needed to go to stop drinking. I had I love that. Sometimes your defects will help you. You know, God will use your defects to help you sometimes. I had dated a guy who got a DWI in Washington, and I had borrowed his car, and when I was drinking in Old Town, Giant Impala and Old Town don't go together. I don't know how many hit and runs I did that day, but it was like bumper cars. Do you know what I mean? It was like I didn't care about the car. I loved that car. Didn't care. It was a nice old Impala. Didn't care about him. Didn't care about me. Didn't care about the other people's cars. God. And so he didn't rat me out and went back to jail for hit and run. And I didn't even know this till I was 5 years sober, because I wasn't aware enough of other people besides myself. And I went to go see him in jail, like a good little semi-wifey. And they made you go to an Al-Anon meeting before you could see your guy. And I was like, wow, this stuff is cool, you know? It was the seed. It was totally the seed. And that was in a really bad part of D.C. where I went to visit him. And I kind of had this, what the hell are you doing, thought, you know. And so when I was in that dark room and my boss had to come to find me, I knew I had to go to an AA meeting. And so... I went to go to Al-Anon meeting, I think, first, because that was kind of where I first got. It's all a little fuzzy. I remember there was no Al-Anon meeting that night, so they said, oh, why don't you come over here, you know? And I did, and it was a really great meeting, and I met my first sponsor there, and I started going to AA. I do have to say that... my family and my friends said, you're not an alcoholic, you know? And I went to like, I know, isn't that a nice thing to say? And you drink just like us, you know, kind of thing. And people just looked at me like something was, my hair was green when I said I was going to AA. And I didn't know that was part of the gig, you know, that your people aren't going to like it. I didn't know that part yet, you know? After a few days, I went back out. And luckily, a year later, I came back in. And I think my mom drove me to my meeting. And I didn't remember that for a few years either. I kind of was looking okay on the outside. But on the inside, I felt like a refugee. I mean, I felt war-torn. I felt really like... my old sponsor used to say, blowing dust in the middle. There is nothing. When I heard the term spiritually bankrupt, I knew exactly what it was. So I was thrilled to be in my first AA meeting. A lot of people say they don't want to go to hang out with those people or those junks or whatever. For me, it was an upgrade. You know what I mean? And I had this great little rationale. I used to drink alone a lot. I used to go to bars. And I used to think that I was going to meet my tribe there, you know. I don't know if I just watched too many, like, Budweiser commercials or where, you know, the fun was always going to happen somehow. But I'd always go to a bar and then drink by myself and then go home, you know. And it was really lonely, but, you know, it could have gotten worse trouble, I guess. But the rationale, but I always thought that the Shazam moment where everything was going to make sense was going to happen sometime at a party or a bar. I don't know why I thought that. That's what I thought. But I was scared to come in AA because I thought I'd be missing whatever that Shazam moment was. You know what I mean? And so I said, well, you know, these people are drunks. I could have met them out there. And so if they're in here now, I guess... that could happen here, you know. I had that really twisted, you know, kind of needed to have some rationale to stay here, you know. So it worked for me, but I was happy y'all were drunks, I guess. And then I was worried that, you know, there was going to be a Hare Krishna moment, you know, where I was had to write a check and you wanted all my personal belongings or something. And so I was waiting for that to happen, but that never happened. I got sober in August. This is my anniversary month of 1988. And so back then, there was a lot of, there wasn't that many young people. And, but it didn't matter to me. There was a lot of old timers that, I go back to Northern Virginia, now there's people with 50 years of sobriety, you know. I hooked up with a really good girlfriend who's still my friend today, and they called us the Julie McCoys of AA. We were the cruise directors. There were so many AA dances, and we would say, okay, we're going to a meeting in whatever, what other town. And everybody would show up in a parking lot with like 8 cars, and we'd all caravan over and then have a big breakfast afterwards. And that was like so much fun. I did that for a couple of years at least. You know, I was kind of worried about not having fun, you know, at 22 years old or whatever. I was worried about not having fun. In fact, I was ready to not have fun. I was totally ready to not have fun if I didn't have to die. And I was like, it's funny how many things you think subliminally that you realize later, but I thought I was going to have to play shuffleboard and backgammon for the rest of my life. But that was it. That was going to be like the high point of, you know, my living. And as you'll see, it wasn't. So anyway, in fact, you know, on my first week of sobriety, I think they invited me to like a pizza party and bowling. And being a recovering cool, you know, person, I thought my life had ended. And in fact, I remember they had like, it wasn't even regular pizza. It was like they had aluminum foil underneath the pizza, and it was so homey looking. I thought that it was just like, oh my God. But that kind of gives me a pause now about how how I thought things should be and how judgmental and critical I was. But, you know, that same night, I had a blast. You know, everybody in AA is kind of a comedian. I don't know if you noticed that. But, like, when people are out together, they, like, cut up, they play. They really know how to have... I had an awesome time. And I'm like, okay, this pizza party thing's okay. And that was the decline of my recovering cool. I mean, I had, like, a big leather jacket and big boots and, like, I'm not talking to you and I'm cool and, you know. So so it was really funny that that I could even enjoy myself there. I was really glad that whatever they did, whatever magic that happened in the fellowship of AA kind of penetrated. My early sobriety was tons of AA events, just tons, and meetings. I think I went to a meeting. I was scared not to go to a meeting. I went to a meeting every day for like a lot of years. It was a kind of a good thing when I stopped going to so many meetings because I wasn't treating AA as addictive, as an addiction in a way, you know. So I kind of. That kind of regulated a little bit. I still got a fair amount of meetings, but it was I had to do it for the right reasons, or that I was starting to kind of relax a little bit. I was very manic in my early sobriety. I put myself through college because that was one of my bucket list things, and I was glad that I was manic then because it took it out of me. I'm like, I'm not that manic now. I don't care that much now. But back then, it was good to kind of just spend that energy, newfound energy that I had sober. I had some great sponsors. working the steps, going to step meetings, going to big book meetings. To kind of go back to some life experiences and kind of how the AA lifestyle has not just saved my life, but improved my life. That whole thing that happened with my mom was like really traumatic. Having kind of that kind of level of rejection and being out on the street and everything. In my mind, I thought it was supposed to be like the Waltons, you know, where like the elder woman kind of passes down all her wisdom to the younger ones in this kind of really homey, chummy, everybody's drinking apple cider, fireplace way. And I realized that that was not the lesson that I was going to learn with my mom, okay? My mom was going to be the catalyst for me learning probably the most freeing, best lesson of all, which some people call letting go, but I call it forgiveness. And I found that if I could forgive her, and, you know, it's a lot about losing your ego when you do that too, so it's an inside job as well, but there wasn't much in life that was going to smack me down. There wasn't much in life that was going to be something so horrible that I wasn't going to be able to get up. And that was a really freeing experience. You know, that was a really freeing thing. It took me a while. You know, when and sober, I remember I really like to say, still singing this She Done Me Wrong song, because, you know, if you sober up a horse thief, you still have a horse thief. And so I was still singing that song, and I remember, you know, people pulled me aside in a meeting, and they said, I wish I remember who said it, but they said, what would happen if you just let her off the hook? I was like, well, there's a good idea for you. But it hadn't dawned on me, you know, self-centered. And so that was the beginning of my forgiveness. It took many years after that, but that was the beginning of my chipping away at that. I mean, it was kind of like a rocket. There were certain, you know, I would forgive her more and more and more and more, but, recently, you know, she's mentally ill, so she's also a hypochondriac and likes to kind of let her know that if you don't do X, it's going to kill her, you know? And, I'm kind of smiling because that is such a ridiculous thing, do you know what I mean, to, like, say to someone? But if I didn't have that separation from her, I would feel beholden to save her, do you know what I mean? And I love that feeling of going, wow, that's crazy. You know? I love that because I don't feel responsible for her. I love her. I've learned to love her in a way that doesn't harm me. And that was, like, really huge for me. And, you know, some of the things that happened from that experience of her kicking me out is I realized, one of the first things I realized when I got here was that my drinking could have been a lot longer. You know, I took the short ride because I started young and hit it really hard, you know. So I got here maybe earlier. The other thing that I realized is there is a God. You know, I didn't die. I really could have, you know, many times over. So I felt like someone was taking care of me just from the very beginning. Also, I learned this phrase here in this area. It's not where I grew up in AA, but I had the gift of desperation, and the program stuck, and it didn't unstick. And I'm really grateful for that. I'm really grateful that I was desperate enough to try this program. And in fact, my little one-liner about you know, the gifts of the program, they always come after like a growth experience, you know what I mean? And I keep saying that God's trying to force me to be happy. Because on my own, I don't do it. But so you know, it really brought me a lot of happiness and freedom to like kind of go through that lesson about my mom. Later in sobriety, I got married. We'll make that a short share. It didn't work out. I learned a lot about myself. I learned an awful lot about myself. And again, about letting go and forgiveness. It's amazing what I became willing to do because of my children. Getting along with the ex is really hard. And I feel like I lost a lot of my ego, realizing that I didn't need to win, you know. So I'll thank him from afar for helping me with that. I think he knows it. We get along pretty well right now. But part of that marriage, we had two kids, and one of them was is an autistic. And it's funny because, again, it seems like I feel like almost my whole sobriety was teaching me not to be a victim. You know, she done me wrong song. That why I never said why I'm an alcoholic. I said, damn, this is a great lifestyle. Let's do it. You know, I have an autistic kid, and I'm like, I didn't really say why me. You know, I actually jumped right into action. And trying to help this kid. I processed some grief a little bit later. What was really wonderful is that I had a roadmap, a blueprint for recovery. Autism is like a lot like recovery, where there's no silver bullets. You do a little bit at a time, and like within, you know, a certain period of time, you can see growth and milestones, you know. I found out in AA that I wasn't the extrovert party girl that I was trying to be. I'm kind of a geek and an introvert. So when it came time to research autism, I was like up every morning at 4:30 on the computer for a couple hours. You know, that was my thing, you know. I had been trained as an analyst, and part of my work experience came in handy, you know. So, and I knew through you people, who are the most accepting people on the planet, that I loved my son just the way he was, you know. And it was kind of like I prayed that he would get better, but just have a good life. You know, that's what I wanted. I lost somewhere in the recovery process, I lost that measuring stick of thinking things should be a certain way, you know, like the Walton Family Christmas, or, you know, whatever is supposed to be happening, the Marcia Brady experience, or whoever I was measuring myself against, you know what I mean? Things were just not ever the way I thought they were going to be. And I learned if I just tried to get the gift out of it, that was really the best approach, instead of trying to, you know, force everything into a certain construct. And so the gift really that I got from my son is kind of really hard for me to share about, because I just lost so much garbage in an effort to be a good mom to him. Ego, know, this is a kid who, when he would get mad, he sometimes had tantrums, and he would hurt me. Okay? I wish you could see him now. You wouldn't even notice. You wouldn't even know. And I had to learn it wasn't about me. And that's really hard when it comes to your kid, you know, when you see someone. And even his suffering was not about me. And I wasn't going to fix it. I was going to help, but I wasn't going to fix it. That was really hard that I wasn't going to fix it. And so I accepted my higher power. I accepted him. I accepted everything just as they were. Not that I wasn't going to do the legwork, mind you, but I can't say, you know, how much weight that kind of took off of me for all areas of my life, you know. And often when I share my story or share in a meeting, I hope there's a way I can tell him thank you someday. This guy's, you know, just to give you a little bit, I had people telling me, you know, God works. I mean, telling me that he's getting better and we don't, than the other kids, and we don't know why. You know, he's, another thing that happened, that he would have tantrums when I was out in public. Now, every parent knows that if your kid's having a tantrum in public, you know, you just got to deal with it. But his tantrums were like, And, you know, I had to just give it up. I just had to give it up, you know? And I'm glad to be that person that just doesn't care what people think or what's going on or, you know, what. So right now, he is, I think he's going to have a wonderful life, you know? Just to kind of, when he was having tantrums and going, not talking and not able to communicate when he was a lot younger, I didn't know what was going to happen, you know, and I had to just, you know, try to do what I could and be okay. And now it's kind of funny that he's a cartoonist, you know, he's prolific. He taught himself to ride a unicycle. He's doing amazing in school. He still, you know, gets supports for his autism, but, you know, I don't think he's going to be a rocket scientist. You know, he might be a pizza deliverer, but he's doing really well, and his milestones, even though different than my other child, are just as make me just as happy, you know, to see him meet those, you know. So what else? I love sponsoring people. I feel so purposeful. And it's not because I hand the great wisdom from down high to the other ones. It's because they're teaching me. And it's almost like I can feel the, I guess it's kind of magic when you're working with somebody to connect and to see people grow. And to feel growth myself, because if you've ever sponsored someone, you know, the thing that comes out of your mouth is generally really good advice to you. I'm like, oh, God, I guess I should do that, you know? Yeah, that was a good one. Yeah, maybe I'll try that, you know? So, you know, the big guys working in the room, you know. And I grew up without many worries, without many much groundedness, and being in AA, it makes me feel really grounded. It's really it's really nice to have a place to go. You know, if you're feeling bad, I have a place to go. You know, or you know, to celebrate too. But you know, I call these the spirit. I'm a sci-fi, and part of my geekdom is a sci-fi nut. I call these my spiritual portals, you know. God like checks in here, and people who share are talking God language, you know. It's like I get to kind of go, I know I have a secret map or something, you know what I mean? I know where all the portals are, you know, that the index of meetings. I get to go. I mean, that's how I feel now. I mean, it's not getting any better out there. I mean, like, I watch my family members and people suffer so because they don't have a way to process their pain. You know, anymore, you know, I realize that if I'm in dire straits, it's because I'm not working the steps. And usually, and that's really good, you know. It's not because I'm a lunatic, which is the way, where I used to go. Oh, I must need to check in somewhere. It's like, it's the beginning of the first step for me. You know, I'm feeling crappy. Things aren't working. Relationship sucks or something. Excuse my friend, my almost French. That's like a warning flag that I have work to do. You know, I call myself a recovering loner because when I first got sober, I did not want a sponsor and I didn't want to do it your way. I wanted to play and go to you know, AA dances, but I didn't want to do the work. And I didn't want you guys, I think I was terrified. I didn't want you guys to know me. You know, I didn't want, I didn't even know I was terrified. I couldn't, because I didn't have a sponsor. If I didn't have a, I mean, if I wasn't telling someone I'm terrified, they couldn't tell me why I was terrified. You know? So anyway, I feel really grateful to be amongst people because I think if there was something that was the scariest thing ever, it would be to have someone get to know who I was. I think part of that was kind of the upbringing, but I'm glad that I think part of the things that when things happened to me and early and throughout my sobriety, I knew I couldn't do it alone. You guys told me I couldn't, you know, that you didn't have to do it alone. And then after I tried it by myself for a while, I got to the point where I knew I didn't have to do it alone and I could reach out. So that was kind of my early sobriety. But now I have all kinds of great people around me who, you know, taking inventory and talking about the things that trigger me is everyday conversation. You know, when I first got sober, it was like, let's do your 4-step. And it was like this kind of like everybody, all of my peers were like, you know, that got sober and I did, but scared to do their 4-step. Now it's like, hey, hun, you know, can you not do that because blah, 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 you know, or I'm feeling a little, ha, ha, ha. Can we talk about it? Oh my God, is that like how normal people live, you know? I'm really happy to kind of be in this place where I'm not scared to be wrong. That's the other thing. Woo. You know, if someone says that to me, you know, and says, hey, you know, what's up with this and what's up with that behavior? I'm like, oh, really? You know, and I'm willing to talk about it and like look at it. And I've done so many fourth and fifth steps that it's ingrained now. I actually kind of like being wrong sometimes because there's maybe a better way to do it. Plus, what I do is for a living right now is tons of collaboration, tons and tons. And it's more interesting to me to hear what other people think than it is to just think what I think. I can do that anytime, you know. But like, you know, it's really interesting to see how people view, you know, I do strategy, I do communications, I do advertising design type stuff sometimes too. But it's really interesting to see how people, what people think of different images and different words and different things like that. You know, it dawned on me that that having people do just what I wanted them to, or behave just the way I wanted them to, or have the same thoughts as I did, is as simple as that sounds, that's how I was running my life. I wanted to be comfortable, so I wanted everybody to kind of think the way I thought and do the way I did things. And now I think kind of being blown out of the water with a couple of life events and reaping the gifts from those, it's really much more interesting to have a relationship with people, not just what I project on them. You know what I mean? So, what else? I feel really grateful to be here and to see some familiar faces, especially. I'm very glad to be asked to speak. And I think I am winding down right now. So thank you, everyone, for listening. It was great, really great.